Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we're going to highlight a program that's new to Utah Public Radio and a show that will get an additional broadcast on UPR. We'll talk to a couple of very interesting hosts of those programs. In the first part of the program, we're going to be talking with Julie Rose, host of Top of Mind, a weekly program from BYU Radio that tries to tackle tough topics in a way that's honest and probing, but also leaves people feeling empathetic and empowered. Their slogan is becoming better citizens, kinder neighbors, and more effective advocates. We'll have that on starting in a couple of weeks, Sundays at 9 a.m. In the second half, we're going to talk with Nikki Beatty, the host of BBC's The Arts Hour. We have that on Fridays. And we're going to add a broadcast on Sunday afternoons at 1. BBC's The Arts Hour touts itself as the best global arts coverage from across the BBC. Julie Rose is a seasoned journalist and multiple winner of Edward R. Murrow Awards, 2 national for radio writing and multiple regional for continuing coverage, hard news reporting, writing, use of sound, features, and other categories. She earned her bachelor's degree in communications from Brigham Young University, started in radio at KCPW in Salt Lake City. And she's produced spots and features, news stories from National Public Radio's Morning Edition and All Things Considered. Prior to her work at BYU Radio, she worked as a regional reporter for political, social, and economic stories in North and South Carolina at WFAE Public Radio in Charlotte. She's also worked as a nonprofit fundraiser and public relations manager in the San Francisco Bay Area. Julie Rose, thanks so much for talking to us today.
No, it's my pleasure, Tom. I'm so happy to be here.
And we're so happy to have Top of Mind on Utah Public Radio. Love the program. Before we get to that, we'll talk about Top of Mind. I want to talk about you. So where did you grow up? How did you get to BYU?
I'm a Provo girl.
Oh, okay. All right.
So I went across the street from Provo High School to BYU. We moved to Provo when I was 8 or so. My parents had both gone to BYU. Those were their halcyon days, right? So they figured out how to get back to Provo as quickly as they could and mostly raised us downtown Provo. So I went to Provo High, went to BYU, and then left the state. I thought I was done with Utah. Yeah. I was like, I need to get out and see the world a little more. So I went to California, Bay Area, loved that for a while. Came back to Salt Lake City for a while where I got into radio. I got into radio after I did public relations initially in college. So I spent some time in PR and fundraising in the late 90s, early 2000s before switching into radio.
Yeah. There's kind of a back and forth. You see sometimes people in news go to public relations, a little bit back and forth, right? Did you... You ended up with a communications degree at BYU. What did, PR, that's what you thought you wanted to go into?
Yeah. Well, I mean, if I'm being really honest, Tom, I wanted to be a journalist. But I was a little chicken about the deadlines and the police beat and the sort of like print news world seemed really intimidating to me. I didn't know about radio. The only options at BYU when I was there were either print or TV, neither of which really seemed like what I wanted to do. And then, you know, so I was like, well, I'll do PR because I like to write. So maybe that's the thing. So I did that and it was great. Great program. Funnily enough, so NPR existed, right? But I don't know. I was like my mom was like a conservative talk radio head, right? So that's the only like radio I was aware of that was ever on anywhere. and that wasn't really of interest to me. When I moved to the Bay Area right after college to work in the tech industry with this little boutique PR agency launching internet startups. It was like pre-social media. I don't know. There was like this really big bubble. It was super exciting in the late 90s. I was really poor and housing was expensive then. It's even worse now in the Bay Area. So I had no TV. I couldn't afford cable, nothing like that. So radio was my entertainment. And so I fell in love with the NPR station in my area and just was captivated. I would spend Saturdays like scheduling my errands around being able to listen to This American Life and, you know, all of the kind of like storytelling shows, right? And I was like, how come I didn't know that existed? I want to be a storyteller. But I thought it was too late, you know? I thought, well, I missed my chance. I didn't do I did PR instead. Here's what I'm doing. This will just be my thing that I enjoy. But as it happened, a number of years later, I just got more and more into it. I actually, big props to KRCL at the time. This was in the early 2000s when I moved back to Salt Lake City. I was raising money for a nonprofit, and KRCL was doing community training. I mean, one of the reasons why these stations, community stations, are so valuable, right? KRCL was like, you could just come and learn how to edit audio and sort of work with somebody who was an audio producer. So I signed up for that, did that, went through that little course that they had. They let me use their facilities to use Audition for the first time, which is the software that a lot of people still use to edit their audio. And I was like, this will be great. I'll buy a little bit of equipment on half.com, which was like pre-eBay. Again, this is like 2002, right? And this will be a hobby. So I produced little sound postcards about my grandma, little tributes, kind of just channeling my Ira Glass, just for kicks. It was my fun. And then I had a friend whose sister-in-law, actually Jennifer Napier Pierce, was running. Again, people, she at the time was the, I think she was the All Things Considered host and also kind of the news director at KPCW. In Salt Lake City, which was only heard really in the Salt Lake Valley. And so she's like, I'll introduce you. And so Jennifer gave me a chance to just sort of experiment. So, for like a year or so, I just as again, as a hobby, I'm like, you don't have to pay me. I just want to learn. I'll go to the state fair. I'll go to city council meetings. I had a day job. I had a mortgage. So it wasn't like I was looking to change careers necessarily, but just this is just super fun for me and I want to learn how to do it. One thing led to another. They had a need about a year and a half later and for a full-time reporter to cover the legislature in a really short-term thing. And at that point, Brian Schott was there and who's another local reporter in Salt Lake City. And yeah, they gave me a chance. The rest is history.
Yeah, I love the folks at KCPW. We had partnerships with them before they unfortunately
Yeah.
went under.
May it rest in peace.
May
But
they
man, it
may
was
they
the little station that
little
I could.
station
And
that
it was
could,
so exciting to be at downtown Salt Lake City at the public library and just like getting into the weeds of Salt Lake County issues, Like that really taught me the value of, I think it was there that I learned how to get into like how to cover stuff that you would think would be super boring, like a county council meeting or a legislative caucus, a legislative bill that was being heard in committee, right? But also figure out how to tell that story in a way that would be intriguing and that would make people want to keep listening so that they could get informed, like to wrap important information in good storytelling. That was really where I learned the power of that. So.
This might be a good time to, I was going to do this a little later, but good time to kind of ease into a pitch here for our
Yeah,
listeners.
man, support your public radio
What
stations.
so what is it what was it you discovered there in San Francisco? Was it KQED that you were listening to?
Okay, I'm really embarrassed. It has to have been. It must have been. I mean, I was so naive to how public radio worked at the time that all I knew was that there was this one station on my car radio and my actual like boom box from the 90s that I had in my little apartment in San Mateo, California, that I could turn it on. And I would even like, I had like a little old Walkman, right? I would like carry it around in the grocery store because I wanted to like tune in and not miss the stories on This America. And I couldn't time shift it. They didn't have websites. There was no podcasting. So it was like, gotta listen when it's live. I don't want to miss the story. It's like missing the movie, Yeah. So it must have been KQED in the Bay Area.
And then you said, I want to get into this. You mentioned storytelling. That's a word we use a lot for public radio, right? And now everybody does public radio. They call it podcasting, right? I wonder, maybe get into the essence of that. What's so attractive? And then you started doing it, right? Some people say, well, if public radio went under, you got a whole bunch of other channels and got all these podcasts and stuff. What would be lost if we lost public radio?
Well, there, and now that I'm in podcasting world, right? I know how difficult it is. Like, anybody can have a podcast. It's not hard at all, as we all know. Anybody can have a podcast and can tell stories the way they want to tell stories. I think about what my life would have been if I had started as just an independent podcaster without the structure around a newsroom, editors, accountability, decisions that are getting made outside of my own head and my own biases, right? I think there's something really powerful to. And that is what public radio has offered, and I hope it can continue to offer, which is enough of a structure to say, hey, we have an editor, we have a couple of reporters, we have news meetings, and we're sharing ideas, and we're challenging one another to think about our biases, because we all have them, right? And to try to figure out how can we tell this story in a more compelling way. So for me, some of the most important lessons I learned about storytelling and the best work that I ever did at public radio was because I had editors who pushed me to be more concise, to be more engaging, to be more accurate, right? To be more balanced. And I can tell the difference. I mean, there are lots of independent journalists and independent content creators out there who are making podcasts, but it's not the same thing as the kind of rigorous effort to tell stories. And yes, bias exists, and we all have bias. And I think every media outlet is getting pushed to be more aware of their biases and how they present those and address those. And I think it's a level of storytelling and rigor that that we would really lose from our podcasting world and from the airwaves if public radio went away.
So we hope you'll support Utah Public Radio right now during our fall fund drive. You can go to upr.org, upr.org, that's upr.org. Click the green donate button. Or you can call 800-826-1495, 800-826-1495. Of course, we've lost federal funding, and so that's an extra $200,000 per year that Utah Public Radio has to come up with. That might sound overwhelming, but if you kick in a little extra, right, or if you become a new member of Utah Public Radio and we pool our resources, we can do this and continue this service. 800-826-1495, 800-826-1495, or upr.org. Don't forget that we're partnering with Post Consumer Brands. They'll send two boxes of cereal to Utah Food Bank with your donation right now to upr.org. Or 800-826-1495.
Tom, if you'll let me,
yeah, go ahead.
I always think about, you know, because I'm like a total bargain hunter, and I think about, all right, am I getting my money's worth out of the things that I invest in? I have a habit that I'm not proud of it, but I also am not willing to let it go. And that is that every day in the middle of the day, I go down to the gas station on the corner and I get myself a 32-ounce Diet Mountain Dew, and I pay about $1.50 for that. And I do that every single day. And when I don't get to do it, I'm really grumpy. And then I think about, okay, how many times during the day or during the week am I hopping into my car and there's my local public radio station, UPR, KVR, whatever it is, right? I hop into my local public, my car, and there it is, and I'm getting some value out of that for however many minutes. Let's be honest, I'm getting more out of that probably than that Diet Mountain Dew, and I'm getting some satisfaction, but it's just there and I don't have to put cash out for it. So for me, it's especially about like, look, I use this. I'm going to pay for it.
Yeah, very well said. Yeah, add your support to those who have already called. Help us to reach that goal for this drive. Just a couple of days left in the drive. 800-826-1495, 800-826-1495, or upr.org. Let's do a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue this journey with Julie Rose. You went to Charlotte, North Carolina, talk about that work. And then we'll talk, obviously, about Top of Mind, Julie's wonderful program, which we are adding to UPR's lineup Sunday mornings at 9. More following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. We're talking in this part of the program with Julie Rose, host of Top of Mind, a weekly program from BYU Radio. A wonderful program that we're adding to UPR's lineup Sunday mornings at 9, beginning October 5th. So hope you'll tune in for that. We're previewing that today. We're getting to know Julie Rose. Julie Rose, before we take you to North Carolina, next stop in your career. You mentioned bias, and I noticed I'll have to go.
I opened that can of worms, yeah. Didn't I?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, NPR is accused of bias, right? I guess any reporter has to deal with this, right? With confronting their own biases. You did a interview, intriguing. I haven't listened to this. Unpacking Bias and Curiosity in Journalism. So how do you deal with this, and how do you suggest other reporters deal with this?
Yeah, I think this has been an evolution for me, because when I was reporting for, I mentioned my mom was a conservative radio, you know, fanatic, right? Like she was a Rush head, yeah. And so she was kind of distraught when her oldest daughter started working for public radio, mm-hmm. right? She's like, but NPR is so biased. And I was like, but mom, you know me, right? Like, you know, I'm, you know that I try to be fair about things. And so she would like brag about how, well, my daughter's bringing some balance to the airwaves on whatever, right? Which, you know, but it really forced me to think. And over the years, I've thought, because I wanted to be like, yeah, there's no bias, mom. Good journalism is totally objective and unbiased. I have come through a lot of soul searching, and I think a lot of us in the media are coming to this place to realize that there is no such thing as purely objective, straight down the line, not influenced by any bias. And it's not just political bias. There's also bias based on my, you know, my worldview, where I grew up, what kinds of things I've experienced in my life, the challenges that I'm facing that influence the way I see a story, right? The things that are going to be on my radar. We all have blind spots. And I think it's really important. More and more, I've been thinking about what does it take to trust a media outlet? And I think we need to see more media outlets acknowledging upfront the biases that they have. And you can see this trend happening. Like the New York Times now has little summaries where the reporters will explain, I cover this story and here's how and why I cover it, you know, and this is where I come from. This is what my interests are. In order to trust, we need to feel, you know, consumers need to feel like we just need more transparency. And so I try to tell my listeners, in fact, you know, many times there are stories where I have to acknowledge in the episode, like, look, one of them is for Top of Mind. We did an episode about transparency, open records, right? I was like, look, you guys, I'm a journalist. I am a hardcore about open, you know, secrecy is bad. It only, if you're trying to hide things, it only means you're trying to do something shady, right? Like this is my bias. I'm going to work really hard to try to find other perspectives that are going to challenge and counter my viewpoint so that we can, you know, but you know now up front. So anything that comes out of my mouth, you can kind of interpret that as a viewer, as a listener, and notice. I hope you'll notice the ways in which I'm really trying to challenge my own bias and get outside of my own worldview. I think that there's real value in that. The challenge is that listeners have to be okay with that. We can't see the admission of mistakes. Hey, we're correct. I think the more you correct your mistakes, the more reliable you are as a media outlet. Viewers, listeners, readers should value that and not see it as, well, you made a mistake, therefore I can never trust you again. The question is, did they correct it quickly and widely and honestly, right? Or did they try to obfuscate? Like, that's where I think trust, we've been trained as media consumers, and I think also as journalists, and this dates back quite a long ways. I did a whole episode about this, actually, of Top of Mind a year or so ago, about we've been trained to believe that the only reliable journalism is totally unbiased and totally objective. Well, the truth is that human beings cannot be totally objective and totally unbiased. And so we've misplaced that trust. And now we're like, well, we clearly can't trust anybody because nobody's totally objective and unbiased. And that is not a good place to be. What we need to do is look for news outlets. And I think we need more and more news outlets to be open about their mistakes, open about their biases, open with their listeners and readers about how they're trying to counter those biases, why they're talking to certain people, why they don't name certain sources, why the more transparency we can offer, I think that's the only way we're going to rebuild trust in the media. And we know that it's at really low levels right now in this country.
Yeah, it really is. Really is. That is a good pathway forward. Yeah, hope we take that, right?
Yeah.
So it's running a bit out of time, so I'll sort of lightly skip over your time at WFAE. Won Edward R. Murrow Awards. Let's emphasize that, right?
Yeah.
Award-winning journalist. I want to skip to top of mind. I just want to read this from one of the bios I found. You can confirm or deny this, I guess. I'll just quote this. After several years on the air daily, Julie began fighting the urge to avoid the news completely because of how anxious and angry it made her feel. She knew she couldn't be alone in that, so in 2022, Top of Mind became the answer, switching to a weekly podcast that tackles tough topics in a way that's honest and probing, but also leaves people feeling empathetic and empowered. So maybe you flesh that out. A lot of us, including me, feel disillusioned with the news. I come away angry and whatever. So this is your answer, and it is a great program. Tell us about that genesis.
Yeah. So just very briefly, you know, I did 10,000 interviews over the course of 7 years, doing a daily live radio show on satellite radio, Sirius XM for BYU Radio. And I felt like I was really trying to be very balanced and have good conversations. But I also realized that at the end of the day, it just felt like we were chasing the next story, the next conflict, the next big thing that whoever did on Twitter or whatever in the national news. And what good were we doing in the world? And if I, as a journalist, wanted to go home and hide from the news and tune out, like, clearly something's wrong here, right? I'm not the only journalist to have discovered this. A lot of outlets are working on trying to address this through solutions journalism, through better transparency, through more thoughtful ways of covering conflict. I was given the opportunity to reinvent my daily show as a weekly podcast, and that was the opportunity right there to say, what's the kind of conversation or 1 hour a week listening that I would really want to do? I don't want to shy away from the tough topics, but I also don't want to be told how to think. I don't want to just be fed one specific perspective. And I don't want to just hear the perspectives that I expect to hear, which is part of what's so frustrating for me, is that, oh, here's the Democrat or the Southerner or the Utahn saying the thing you expect the Utahn to say or the Democrat to say or whatever, right? I wanted to be surprised. I wanted to feel empathy. I wanted to hear from people who had skin in the game, who'd been personally affected by issues. And I wanted to be able to feel like it wasn't pick a side. It's one side or the other, the end, but that there's more nuance there. And the empowerment piece isn't about me wanting to be like, oh, here's the solution to all the problems. Find me the solution so I can feel good about the world. No, the empowerment is about me realizing, wow, there's more to this than I really thought. I want to go have a conversation about this with somebody in my life. I'm going to think about this differently next time I vote. I clearly have some more reading that I need to do on this. This is a solution I never thought of before, and I wonder if people are working on that in my community. Let me go find out. If people, after they've listened to Top of Mind, have felt a little challenged, have had their worldview expanded a little bit, and if at the very least they want to go read up a little more on this topic, that to me is a great success. And if they're interested in having a conversation with someone in their life, and this is what I really love, people say to me, you know, your episode on whatever, birthright citizenship, really challenged me. I have had, but it equipped me. I listened twice. Someone just told me this like 2 days ago. I listened to that episode twice and it equipped me to have a conversation that I really needed to have with somebody about immigration in my life. So thank you for that. Mm. That's what we're trying to do with Top of Mind.
Slogan, becoming better citizens, kinder neighbors, and more effective advocates. I love that you're trying to, you know, not be Pollyanna-ish, but you know, you're trying to get some positive out of this, right? It's not just table pounding.
These are the tough topics. We're not gonna just stop at the problem. We're gonna acknowledge that it's a hard problem. We're gonna look for opportunity for common ground if it exists. At the very least, look for ways to have more connection with people in our community or to be more effective in working toward the world we want to live in.
Yeah. I know this is always a hard question. Any memorable episode, anything that comes top of mind, pun intended,
yeah, right. You? Okay. For me, the ones that are most memorable are the ones where I have the very experience I want listeners to have, which is that my worldview gets challenged a little bit. So I talked about birthright citizenship. That was an episode for sure. I talked about open government. Like, I, as a journalist, really had to face some challenging perspectives about how more transparency can also lead to more gridlock. and that there is more nuance in that conversation than I was allowing. That was challenging for me as a journalist. And then I'll tell you one just about tipping, right? So I did this episode about tipping because I was so annoyed. And I think your listeners are going to have a chance to hear it. But everywhere we go, you're like at the fast food counter and they turn around the, you know, the little monitor and ask for a tip. And I'm like, well, who am I tipping? Like, am I tipping you because you worked the cash register? Like, am I tipping the person who made my burger? Like, what's going on here? Why are you asking me to tip? Nobody delivered it to my desk. This is really ticking me off. So a lot of episodes start with me kind of being riled up, right? I'm like, as I get into it, talk to people who work for tips, talk to people who are experts, talk to people who, a restaurant owner who tried to do away with tips and then was unsuccessful and had to bring them back. One of the things I really realized was that, well, I'm now a more generous tipper. Now I don't get annoyed. I actually tip generously because of the things I discovered in that episode.
Right.
One of which is that I'm very price sensitive. A lot of companies right now are keeping prices low. So I go to the place that has the burger that's a dollar cheaper. Guess how they're keeping that burger a dollar cheaper? Because they're paying their employee less.
Yeah.
I don't like that. I want them to be fairly compensated. So they take the price out of the burger and then they assume that the tip is going to make that up. And if I don't pay that tip, then I'm not paying what I consider the full fair price of that burger.
Yeah.
It's really changed my total perspective on this. So that's just one example. I love it when I really have to kind of sit with my worldview and examine my own biases in an episode.
Well, we'll get to hear many of these episodes. Top of Mind is coming to Utah Public Radio beginning October 5th, Sunday mornings at 9, Julie Rose's program. So here at the end, maybe another appeal to our listeners. Broadcast of Top of Mind, great programs like that on Utah Public Radio is made possible by you. And so we hope to hear from you at 800-826-1495 or upr.org. Why should people give? Julie Rose?
I mean, again, I just acknowledged that I need to get my money's worth out of things. And I also don't feel good being a freeloader. So for me, it's always been sort of a like, I pay for what I use. And even if I don't agree with every single thing that I hear, that's not an excuse to not pay for, like to not contribute. Like, I don't want to live in a world where all I'm hearing is stuff that totally aligns with my worldview and that I agree with. I mean, that's for me, that is not the way to be a better citizen, a kinder neighbor, and a more effective advocate. And so the thing that I would just encourage people to think about is having a resource like UPR that puts material out there in a way that you can consume and understand your world better and challenges you. That's an incredible resource. It's worth a couple of bucks a day, a month, whatever, my $1.50 that I put into my daily soda run.
Well, here's how to support Utah Public Radio during our fall fund drive. Go to upr.org, upr.org, click the green donate button, or call 800-826-1495, 800-826-1495, and thank you. Julie Rose, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Likewise. I'm so happy that we're going to be in this partnership. I can't wait to be communicating with UPR listeners.
Yeah, it'd be great to have you on again Sunday mornings at 9, Top of Mind with Julie Rose. Thanks so much. Thanks again. And thanks, everybody. We'll go to break. And when we come back, I'll be talking with Nikki Beatty, host of BBC's, yes, The Arts Hour, following this break. On this part of the program, we're pleased to be talking to the host of BBC's The Arts Hour, Nikki Beatty. Nikki Beatty, it's such a pleasure to talk to you.
It's a pleasure to talk to you and to be on your station. Not once, but twice a week, I believe.
That's right. We have had The Arts Hour for several years now on Fridays. Now we're adding it on Sundays. So we wanted to highlight the program. I guess before we jump into Arts Hour, I'd like to get a little bit of your background. Born in England, right?
Yes.
Indian father, English mother.
Correct. So I call myself Indo-Anglian as a bit of a joke because it's a patrilinear world in India. So you would put the father first. So I put Indo first and Anglian. And also because Anglo-Indians are not, they're a particular group of Indians. They are not half English, half Indian in the way that you think they are. So yes, Indian father and English mother is the best way, and a fully flexible heart.
I didn't know this before, but you've had a career in acting. You
That's right.
went to Mumbai, I guess, at a certain point. Tell me a little bit about that. That's interesting.
Okay, well, I started off by doing English language theatre. That's not so surprising. But then I had a Hindi teacher who said, "Oh, I'd like you to meet a man who lives upstairs in my apartment building. He's looking for an actress for a play he's doing." So off I went to meet this man, Abid Surti, and it turns out that the play is in Hindi. I do not speak Hindi. At this point, I can say bad words that my father thought it was funny to teach two white presenting little daughters, but you certainly wouldn't use it as an adult. And I could basically ask for a cup of tea or a lemonade. And so I ended up on a stage delivering lines in Hindi, which I had learnt like a parrot. And if anybody dropped a line, I would not know how to improvise. But as a result of that, because we were playing in the sort of area filmmakers live in Bombay towards the suburbs, there were various people who came to see this play who then said, "Oh, we'll cast her in this series and that series." So I ended up doing a whole lot of stuff in Hindi on television because there was dubbing in those days, or ADR as you want to call it. So I did deliver some line in dreadful Hindi, Tom, and then you'd hear the director saying, "Dubbing me ho jayega," which means we'll fix it in the dubbing. And so that's how I began my career on film and TV in India. But then I also did a Shakespeare play and ended up marrying my Othello. I was Desdemona.
Yeah, that's quite it. That's interesting. So from that, you did that, I guess, for a while, and then how did you get from that to television presenter?
So a TV channel in the UK called Channel 4 had a sort of remit that they must be diverse. Well, that would be the word we use today. So they were serving sections of the UK that other channels didn't. And so they wanted an on-location talk show from India that had somebody who could cross into both worlds. So they did a whole series of auditions in Bombay, as it was known then, and I got picked. And that was my first role as a TV presenter. I had a show called Bombay Chat, and we'd do it from the race course, from the top of a five-star hotel, from the gateway of India. All kinds of incredible places with everyone from Bollywood stars to politicians, rock stars, classical musicians. It was fascinating. And once I did that, Tom, I mean, I don't know how you got the bug for interviewing people, but once I was talking to other people, it was so much more interesting than enacting somebody else's character. So it was an epiphany for me. And it did very well on TV, which then led to a huge talk show throughout Asia. So it was the beginning of a bigger thing.
At a certain point, I'm reading here, you lived and worked in Los Angeles.
I did indeed. So, as I told you, I married my Othello. He had the same sort of genealogy as me in that he was half Indian, half English, but he grew up in India, was a massive star in the West for various things that he'd done. But he was American passport holder, and he got a role in The Bold and the Beautiful. Do you know that
Yes.
daytime soap?
Yes.
Okay. So he always played characters that were either foreign princes or terrorists who, my family would joke, how long do you last in this movie, before you're taken out? He was also a Bond villain in Octopussy,
Oh.
and he died in that, spoiler alert. But or he went off a plane anyway. But he wanted to be in LA to do this stint as a guest role on The Bold and the Beautiful. So we came to LA. I was a green card holder, and we never went back for years. I mean, we split our time between Bombay and LA. But yes, I loved being in America. I absolutely adored it. And to be in Santa Monica on the beach, because I don't drive, Tom, which is a bit of a problem in Los Angeles, or was before the days of, you know, cabs on apps. But that was the one place that you could walk around the streets and not be done for, you know, what are you doing on the streets of Beverly Hills at this time of day? Why are you walking? So, yeah, it was an amazing place.
there's a Steve Martin movie I recall where he goes out, gets in the car and drives two houses down. Right. That's it's kind of epitomizes L.A. Right. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
So then you end up on radio. You've had huge shows on television. Did that feel like a letdown? Of course, this is your current show is huge.
Well, it's interesting because when we moved back to the UK, I was still doing television. But we sort of got adopted into the Asian community. Kabir is a massive Bollywood star. And I'd done this big talk show, so I, you know, I had some fame throughout Asia. So the British Asian community wanted us to be at all these events. And a guy came up to me and said, would you like to be on the BBC Asian Network? It's a radio station. And I said, oh, I've never done radio. Isn't that a craft that's way beyond television? So I said exactly the right thing to this radio head of a man. And I ended up, first of all, working in that division of the BBC, a station called the Asian Network. So I played really atrocious Bhangra music, really excellent Bollywood music, and all sorts of indie pop in between. But I also learned my craft of live radio, and I loved it. So yes, I know what you mean by people saying, oh, is it a come down to do radio? It's not. But I see television, I still do television. But I see television as smoke and mirrors. Even if it's live, it's smoke and mirrors. Everything is there to make you look good, to whereas radio is a hot medium, as Marshall McLuhan once said.
Yeah. By the way, it seems like Bollywood has exploded worldwide.
Oh, yes.
That you've, I guess you've, you know, you were there in Bombay, right?
Yes, absolutely. And I acted in certain films as well. But Bollywood, so people sometimes use the catch-all term Bollywood for the 1,000 films that come out of India every year. But in fact, Bollywood is only in the Hindi language. And a Bollywood film is often considered to what, it's what we call masala movies. So there would be singing, there would be dancing, and the songs sell the film. And that is still the case. And the other 700 films that are made and released in India every year come from different regions. So you have three different types of cinema in the south of India. You have Bengali cinema, you have and Punjabi cinema. But Bollywood is the biggest. It translates everywhere. And the Indian diaspora and the people who love Bollywood, who don't necessarily speak Hindi across the world, is absolutely enormous. It's escapism. And it's, I'd say it's an acquired taste, though.
Yeah. I've been watching a bunch of films in Telugu.
In Telugu. So that's a South Indian.
That's South Indian language. Because that's what you find a lot of on Amazon Prime, for whatever reason.
Do you remember what you watched by any chance?
There's one I really loved. It's called Fida.
Yes.
Fida. I'm trying to remember.
Then there was a big movie from the South called RRR, which actually won an Oscar for something a couple of years ago. Yeah. Again, that's a South movie.
A South movie, yeah. So I guess all over India, these films are making their way around the world, which is great.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And they have the infrastructure in all these places, because labor is so cheap in India, to make a lot of these series for Amazon Prime, for Netflix India. Lots of the streaming services are buying Indian product.
Let's talk about the Arts Hour. How do you describe the Arts Hour?
So the weekly Arts Hour is a combination that we curate as a team of the best arts and culture interviews and conversations from across the BBC and also from beyond, because we can pull from some of our partner stations with permission. So, for example, we use ABC Radio National in Australia's Screen Show sometimes, because Jason DeRosso has interesting filmmakers and actors on that. But in general, it's from the BBC. And what we try to do is we try to get the most interesting conversation that we can then also discuss afterwards in the Arts Hour studio. So if you might have one of the biggest movie stars in the world on the show, but they might not say anything interesting. So we're also looking, we love big names, obviously, but we're also looking for things that will spark conversation and will make our listener really think or think, oh, maybe I should consider this. It's a thinking platform as well as an entertainment platform, I hope. So we also try to get not only a cultural spread in terms of movies, television, literature, music, architecture, dance, all the various disciplines that you could find under the umbrella term, the arts, but also from across the world. So it's those little hidden gems of hearing a Brazilian music collective talking about why their music is so important to their politics, for example. It could be that we are featuring a series that's coming up on Netflix that's in Turkish because it's got a really interesting premise and it could be understandable all over the world. And we do try to have as much global spread in the show across our weeks as possible.
Regularly you go on the road. I love those remote broadcasts. I guess most recently to Romania, but you've been all over the world.
Actually, the most recent one, well done for knowing Romania, by the way, but that was Bucharest. But then after that, we did Bangkok in Thailand. And then we are going to Rome in November. So you'll be able to hear that. Those are the biggest privilege of my life. I cannot believe that I have the honor of presenting shows in cities all over the globe. Not only that, but having a live local audience in the theater or the auditorium that we're hosting the show in, having two live music acts who will each reveal something different about that city and that country. A comedian, because obviously comedy can say things that a lot of other things can't. And then we will have a panel of guests who will talk about their projects and what they do. So it could be a film star, it could be a massive dance star, it could be somebody who's written a best-selling book, somebody who's made a street art poster that turned into a political campaign. I mean, it's so incredibly varied what we're able to showcase on those programs. And the idea is that we do a lot of work before we get there in terms of understanding the city, understanding what might be going on in that country that might be reflected in the arts and culture and entertainment of that place, so that we can be contemporary and so that we can, for you listening, let you have a moment of going, oh, that's what that is. Also, Tom, I'm not very good at reading long, tedious, boring news articles about a country. I'm not very good at reading long articles at all anymore. I think I have fallen prey to this short attention span that so many people around the world have. So with a show like the Arts Hour, you've got these little moments where people say something that makes you think, oh, now I understand what that means. Now I've got an insight into why they suffered in this particular era. And I just find that so incredibly rich and edifying, as well as fun. Mm-hmm. We have so much fun.
Yeah, it does sound like it. Yeah, you're out there. Extra problems, right? Technical problems, potentially, when you're on the road, right? Remote.
Not when you have the kind of engineers that the BBC has. Oh, no. I mean, yes, there are all kinds of issues. So the team are one of those teams, and they do swap depending on where we're going in the world. But they are the kind of people who don't see problems, they only see solutions. So we will not know what those technical producers have had to carry across oceans in terms of kit, as we would call it. We won't know how they've measured what the amplification in that particular auditorium will be for us to be able to have a band of 16 members on stage. I may not know any of these issues, but they, on the night, there is seldom anything that cannot be overcome in terms of technicals. When we go on the road and do our culture cab, it's generally my presenter, who's also called Nikki Paxman. My producer on the road with me. And it will be the two of us with a guest who will be on the show the next day. But we will be traveling around the city with one of those little portable recording devices and two mics, getting that person to tell us stories and show us places that we wouldn't find on our own.
Mm-hmm. I want to follow up on you say you have, I've heard this, you have comedians, you know,
yes.
Everybody else in the arts community in whatever city you're in, but comedians, and that makes sense to me. That's especially revealing of a time and a place and maybe the politics.
Absolutely. And comedians can say things with a joke that we couldn't say, well, not we, but the other guests potentially couldn't say on the stage as a statement or an opinion. Often we go to places where there is not 100% free speech, where you would be in danger of getting into trouble if you voiced an opinion about something that wasn't the leading thoughts way of seeing things. And so if you're disguising information in a joke or a funny story, you can skewer things very subtly and we can get the message. So they are so valuable. And Tom, the other thing that we are doing is we're asking that comedian, wherever we are in the world, to do their comedy set in English. And we've been to places in the world where they have never done their set in English before. So that it's just such an extraordinary thing that they do. And we get to benefit from not only their hard work, but also their witty, you know, observations of the city they're in and the power structures that they live within, the little foibles and idiosyncrasies of their communities. So it's really enlightening.
Do you have a favorite or most memorable interview?
For me personally?
Yeah.
On the Arts mm-hmm. Hour? I mean, I have moments from every single show which take me by surprise, because you can prepare so well for every eventuality. You can have done your background viewing and reading. I mean, if I'm interviewing a filmmaker on stage, I will have watched every single thing that they have made, and I will have read around it, and I will have understood things. But ultimately, something can happen on that stage that totally takes you by surprise. And those are the moments that I savor and remember. I also have had moments when the audiences have taken my breath away. In a show in Mexico City, we had a singer who performed and then explained that her song was dedicated to people who were disappeared. And I needed to understand what she meant by disappeared. And she went on to talk about kidnappings and said that there were people in her family who had been kidnapped. And then I just turned to the audience and said, how many of you know someone or have someone in your orbit, your family, your friend group who've been kidnapped? And almost the whole audience put their hands up. So you have that chilling moment of going, whoa. And also in Colombia, in Bogota, I went to the artist Doris Salcedo's installation, which is called Fragmentos, which means pieces. And you walk into this building, which looks like it's a little beautiful bungalow, whitewashed and very pretty sort of gardens in the front. And you walk in, and to the right, there is an empty room with very thick, almost metallic-looking bumpy tiles all the way across it, huge tiles, floor tiles. And those tiles are made from the melted-down weapons and ammunition of the FARC rebels, who 2 or 3 years before we'd gone to do our show there had laid down their weapons. And these tiles were melted, well, these guns and the ammunition were melted down, and the women who had lost brothers, fathers, sons, grandfathers, cousins, male members of their families, beat those melted down objects of war into these tiles. And then those tiles are laid on the floor. So when you sit on those tiles, you feel the weight of something so monumental that has happened in that country that has now been turned into a piece of memorial art. So moments like that have taught me more about a country than reading a description.
Well, we'll leave it there on that memorable note. We've been talking with the host of the Arts Hour, Nikki Beatty. What a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. And hello, Utah.
Yes, we're happy to have you on. I love the program.
Do you watch The Real Housewives of Salt Lake City?
I have not watched it. No, I've read about it.
Oh, my goodness, Tom, you do not know what you're missing.
Yes, I've read up on it, but I've never watched it. Yeah.
Well, if you want any dope on those women, come to me.
Okay. All right.
I'm an avid fan.
I'll come to you first. Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you, Tom.
Okay. Thank you. Bye now.
Bye. Bye.
Such fun to talk with Nikki Beatty and Julie Rose in this hour. You can hear Top of Mind with Julie Rose on UPR on Sundays, 9 a.m., and BBC's The Arts Hour on Sundays at 1 p.m. beginning October 5th. So we're highlighting the programs today. Tom Williams, joined now by Debbie Andrew. We are hoping that you'll support great programs like Top of Mind and Arts Hour and Access Utah with your call right now to 800-826-1495, 800-826-1495, or go to upr.org. And Debbie, when you do that, that'll cause some other great things to happen.
Yeah, it will. We have a gift for food partnership with Post Consumer Brands and the Utah Food Bank. So during our fall fund drive, we're helping Utahns that are facing food insecurity. So when you donate to UPR, partner Post Consumer Brands will make a donation to the Utah Food Bank. All of your donation stays at UPR and also provides two boxes of cereal to hungry families all over Utah. So the total is 500 contributions by Friday at 7. And once we hit our goal, that means that 1,000 boxes of cereal will go out to people in need. So that is automatic. You don't have to choose it when you go to UPR.org. It automatically happens with every donation.
So that's a great thing. You can do two good deeds with one act, and that act is calling 800-826-1495 or go to upr.org.
Yeah, do it now, especially if you're, you know, just thinking about this for the first time. Now is a great time because we have lost federal funding and we could really use your support.
So that's $200,000, not just one time, but every year, and that's extra. It's on top of what we've been doing. Now, that could seem overwhelming, but if you'll increase your donation, if you'll become a member of Utah Public Radio for the first time, then we can do this. 800-826-1495 or upr.org. And thanks, everybody, for listening to Access Utah.